Back there to 2 Peter chapter 1. And for several weeks now, we have been engaged in a careful look at these verses that open up this epistle. The passage goes all the way down to verse 11 before Peter gets into a slightly different topic. But really, the whole book has to do with the idea of developing spiritual stability. And that's been our focus as we have looked now for several weeks at these opening verses. I mentioned earlier, last time we were engaged in looking at three of these virtues that he lists that we're calling the elements of spiritual stability. And those would be, first of all, knowledge, secondly, self-control, and then number three, patience or perseverance. And we have three left to look at today as we round out the list. Godliness, and then on into verse 7, we're looking at brotherly kindness, and then finally charity or love. Now, how do you feel about picking apart the Christian life in terms of all of these very specific and sometimes challenging and convicting and maybe even overwhelming character traits? Maybe like somebody would feel if they picked up the South Carolina DMV driver's manual and they look up the section that tells them how to drive a car with a manual transmission. And it goes like this. First of all, you've got to put the car in motion. And that involves seven steps. With clutch pedal to the floor, move the lever from neutral to first. Number two, depress the foot brake and release the parking brake. Number three, signal. Check for traffic in both mirrors. Number four, check traffic ahead and behind by glancing over your left shoulder. Number five, if clear, accelerate slightly and release the clutch slowly. If you release it suddenly, the car will jerk forward and the engine may stall. You will feel the engine take hold and begin to move the car. The point where the engine takes hold is called the friction point. Number six, hold the clutch momentarily at the friction point. Number seven, gradually press down on the accelerator and let the clutch up all the way. And that was seven steps for putting the car into motion. The next phase, shifting from first to second. Number one, and this would be at about 10 or 15 miles per hour, press the clutch down. Two, release the accelerator. Three, move the gear shift lever into second. A slight pause as you go across neutral into second will help you shift smoothly. Number four, accelerate gently as you release the clutch, hesitating briefly at the friction point. That was from first to second. Stopping from upper gears is another issue. When stopping from third, fourth, or fifth, always use the brake pedal first to slow down before pressing down the clutch. By keeping the car in gear, the engine helps slow the car. In an emergency, applying the brakes without using the clutch at all will stop the car. Follow these steps to stop the upper gears. Number one, check mirrors for traffic. Number two, let up on the accelerator. Number three, tap brake lightly to signal for a stop. Number four, brake gradually. Five, press clutch pedal down. Six, brake to a smooth stop. Shift into first or the proper gear when stopped. And then downshifting. Downshifting, this is profound, means shifting from a higher gear to a lower gear. The engine has greater pulling power in lower gears than in higher ones. If you have slowed down to about 15 miles an hour in a three-speed transmission and need to regain speed, you must downshift from third to second. Depress the clutch, shift to second, accelerate gradually, let the clutch out, pausing briefly at the friction point. Depress the clutch, shift back into third when proper speed has been obtained. You should downshift for out of control and when slowing down before entering a very sharp turn. Downshifting can also be used for extra pulling power when climbing long or steep hills. Downshift just before the engine begins to labor. Don't wait until it is almost stalled. Using second gear going down a long or steep hill saves wear on the brakes since the engine helps slow the car down. Let the clutch out after every downshift. Now, for those of you who drive a manual transmission, that seems like an utter waste of time and more complicated than it really is, because you are so used to this and it is such a smooth operation for you. But this might be helpful for somebody who is just getting started. And it might be helpful for you occasionally as well. If you get into certain ruts and maybe you are riding the clutch too much, or if you are failing to look around enough, even though it is kind of overwhelming to picture all of these steps and actually walk yourself through them all, there is a value sometimes in taking it apart and looking at individual pieces of the whole package. We all need these sorts of reminders. We all need careful attention because we all do fall into ruts in life, and we might be neglecting something very important. In this case, it might end up, I don't know, messing up your transmission, and then you'd be going to see Philip. Well, that is maybe the feeling as we get to looking at these character qualities. And we have an idea of the Christian life, and here we are breaking it down into all these individual character traits, and it's like, how in the world can I be working on all of these things at once? And why keep coming back to these things and defining them carefully and looking at them so closely? Well, I want us to look ahead at verse 12 and notice Peter's attitude as he explains why he is doing this. He says, I will always be ready to remind you of these things, even though you already know them and have been established in the truth which is present with you. I consider it right, as long as I'm in this earthly dwelling, to stir you up by way of reminder. And so he knows that perhaps we pretty much understand what these different terms mean. But he also knows our weakness and our tendency to forget. People remind us of things because we forget. And the Lord guided him to remind us in such a way that it ended up in writing, so that, verse 15, even after Peter dies, these reminders are in the Bible and we return to them again and again and are in a regular mode of evaluating ourselves. I could just ask you, as you look back on this week, did you at all reflect on the three character qualities we looked at last Sunday? Knowledge, remember that? Temperance or self-control, and then patience or perseverance. Did you one time this past week think about any of those qualities? And beyond that, did you make any concerted effort to grow in those areas, to stretch yourself, to take some step to develop that, to display that? Or are these largely words on a page that sound good and good to be thought about on a Sunday? We all always need to be confronted with our responsibilities because of our tendency to forget, and how easy it is to slide back into old habits and walk out the doors of a church and go on with our lives and not actually apply the Scriptures. And so we need to take a look at what remains, and this morning we will be looking at these final three elements of spiritual stability, which are godliness, brotherly kindness, and love. And we'll be doing the same thing we did last time, approaching each of these with three basic questions. What, why, and how? What does this mean? Why is it so necessary? And how do I go about actually developing this quality? Starting off, first of all, with godliness. What does godliness mean? This is one of the more abstract of the terms in this list, and maybe a little hard to get our hands around. What we're talking about here is that in Christian growth, you are dealing not just with actions, not just with external manifestations. Dave was dealing with some of this morning, that in terms of how we define lying, there may be a technical definition that we might feel okay about, but then when it is taken to the level of the heart and really applied fully as to what is going on in the nuances of your speech and what is going on in the heart behind why you're saying what you're saying, God is putting His finger on something deeper than just merely an action or words coming out your mouth. That's what is going on here. Godliness is the attitude that pervades all of these different character qualities. other words that have been used to describe this, the word piety. Or maybe longer phrases like living a God-word or God-centered life. Or living with an awareness of God. Or living with a certain motive, with a view to pleasing God, not just ticking things off of a list of what I do and what I don't do. But what is the motive behind that? What is compelling me to live that way? And it is an expression of an attitude to God, trying to bring God into the picture of all my choices. Another word that's commonly used is the word devotion. And that as well as open misunderstanding, because it is vague, and we might have an overly emotional definition of devotion, thinking that it's all about this kind of mountaintop experience, or we might be thinking of a certain specific discipline, like I get up in the morning and I have my devotions. And what that word means to us in that case is I've read my Bible and I've prayed, and now I go on with my day. That is not what devotion as such is or is limited to. In the history of Christian literature, I'm sure you would be aware that the most read and the most influential book outside the Bible is John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. You may not know what the second most influential Christian book has been. By the opinion of some historians, it's actually a book written about a century after Bunyan, and not nearly as engaging or as interesting, but had a profound impact in the 18th century. Impact on people like John Wesley and George Whitefield. It was a very probing and specific book that had to do with this idea of devotion. The author's name was William Law. And the book's title was A Serious Call to a Devout and Holy Life. And this is how he went about defining this idea of devotion. He said, devotion is neither private nor public prayer. So don't equate devotion merely with praying. But prayers, whether private or public, are particular parts or instances or examples of devotion. Devotion signifies a life given or devoted, given over to God. He therefore is the devout man who lives no longer to his own will or the way and spirit of the world, but to the sole will of God, who considers God in everything, who serves God in everything, who makes all the parts of his common life parts of piety. If you think of all the mundane things that fill your day. Everything from brushing your teeth, to doing the dishes, to putting together something at work, maybe writing up a report, or selling something, or building something, fixing your car, driving your car, putting your kids to bed, brushing their teeth. All of these things that seem to have so little value, and in the light of eternity, to mean next to nothing. Well, he says devotion is doing all of those little insignificant things with a certain mindset. Doing everything in the name of God and under such rules as are conformable to his glory. Maybe even with that definition of godliness or devotion, we might still be struggling. It is still a vague concept, and so I want to jump forward about 250 years to a contemporary author whose writings are extremely helpful. His name is Jerry Bridges. And he says this, devotion is not an activity. It is an attitude toward God. This is coming from his book, The Practice of Godliness, which is precisely what we're talking about. And very helpful, he says, this attitude is composed of three elements. As far as what ought to be my attitude toward God, he says, first of all, the fear of God. There's something to stop and define carefully and consider. Am I operating throughout the day with an attitude of fear toward God? What does that mean? What maybe does that not mean? And how does fearing God combine with the second element that Bridges gives us, the love of God? And then there is a third element, desire for God. There's something for you to reflect on as you evaluate the level of your godliness. What he is saying is, examine what's happening in your heart as you're engaged in whatever you're doing, not just when you're reading your Bible or witnessing to somebody, but in every action of life. Evaluate, is this a reflection of a fear of God? Am I doing this out of a heart that loves God? Am I doing this because I personally desire God and His fellowship and His presence? Bridges goes on to say, the practice of godliness is an exercise or discipline that focuses upon God. From this Godward attitude arises the character and conduct that we usually think of as godliness. And so Peter here is urging us to go beyond specific activities and examine the condition of our heart, whether our motive is one of love for God and pleasing Him. Now, why is this necessary? That's our second question for all these virtues. Not just what does it mean, but why is it that this is so critical? And last time, I think I made you aware of the fact that these character qualities are picked by Peter for a very specific person and for a very specific purpose. They're not just chosen at random out of any number of character qualities, but he has something in mind that he's trying to keep them away from, and he has a very specific situation in that church in mind, and that is the entrance of these false teachers in chapter 2. And as you read chapter 2, compared to this list, you find that these men are actually displaying the opposite of every one of those character qualities. If you look at chapter 2, verse 6, as well as chapter 3, verse 7, both times these men are described specifically as the opposite of this quality, as ungodly people. And when that idea comes up, if we ask why is it so necessary to develop this quality, when that comes up, it comes up as the reason why these men are going to be destroyed someday. Look with me at chapter 3 and verse 7. As he is dealing with the false teacher's denial of the coming of Christ, he says, 3:7, but by his word the present heavens and earth are being reserved for fire, kept for the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men. Peter is choosing his words here very carefully, and he is working in the opposite of this character quality and saying this is what brings condemnation on people. Would you say it would be pretty important to have a godly heart if you're interested in being free from the wrath of God someday? Well, look at how he applies this later on in the chapter, chapter 3 now, verse 11. We're familiar with the statement of verse 10 about how the heavens and the earth are going to be destroyed with this intense heat. Everything burns up. Application, verse 11. Since all these things are to be destroyed in this way, what sort of people ought you to be in all holy conduct and godliness? There's the term again. There's the idea. The way I like to express that, just trying to package up what is being said here with this prophecy of the coming destruction, is believers pursue this kind of attitude that fleshes itself out in a holy lifestyle because they know what's going to happen to people whose lives are characterized by the opposite, and because they don't want to come close to being burnt up when the earth gets burnt up. The writer of Hebrews says that without holiness, nobody will see the Lord. And even though we understand that we are saved and sanctified by the grace of God, and that secures our ultimate salvation, the New Testament never leaves it at that, but always has this emphasis on the kind of people who are going to be delivered from that coming wrath. Are people whose hearts have been reoriented to God. And it is a spirit of I don't want there to be any chance that I would end up burnt up with this world. That is part of what drives me on to develop a Godward mentality and a Godward life. Well, that's kind of the negative side. This is the judgment that Peter wants us to avoid that moves us on to develop godliness. But I think that there is more motivation that we could add to that. And that would be the danger, even as a Christian, or maybe as an outsider, as someone who does not yet know the Lord, looking at these elements of godliness and getting confused between what we would call morality and true godly character. The danger of developing those traits out of a heart that is oriented to self instead of a heart that is doing those things out of worship to God. And that would include even the emphasis that this passage itself is going to give in just a moment on personal relationships. And so often, even as Christians, we can become satisfied when we know that on the horizontal level, everything is okay between me and other people, and yet forget that there is this vertical relationship that ought to be at the foundation of it all, and that keeps that from being just morality. Remember what we said about Benjamin Franklin a few weeks ago, and how he had made a very, very careful effort and study to develop many of these same traits in his life, but here would be one of the fatal flaws in his case, that it was not a Godward thing, at least not as the Bible defines who God is and how we get right with Him. It was merely a horizontal effort in morality. And we could find many contemporary parallels to Benjamin Franklin today. I think of a famous writer who a number of years ago put out an international bestseller where he opened up his own heart as to growth that had taken place. He said that there were some real concerns that his wife and he had about one of their sons and how he just wasn't fitting in and how he wasn't doing well in school and wasn't good at sports and embarrassed them and the family, and they did everything that they could to try to help him and encourage him and motivate him to fit in and excel and do better. And while this was going on at work, he was reading, as part of what he did to train executives, he was reading on the history of character development. And he recognized that there had been a great shift toward the middle of the 20th century here in this country, where before there was an emphasis on what he calls character ethics and honesty and integrity and principle, to what has become a lot more prominent and is what people emphasize today, and that is personality ethics and charisma and knowing how to work with people almost to where you know how to manipulate them to get them to do what you want. And all of this came together in his life, and he realized, you know, I've got a problem here. One of the problems is, in the case of my son, the reason I'm so concerned about him doing well is because I'm getting my own security from how he does and how he impresses or doesn't impress people with his behavior, and it's my own pride that's hurt when I see him mess up. And in the context of that discussion, he quotes Proverbs 4:23 is summarizing the lesson that he learned, keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it flow the issues of life. And he even goes on to say, I believe that correct principles, such as he's teaching in this book, principles about honesty, principles about deliberateness, principles about genuine concern for people and selflessness, are natural laws, and that God the Creator is the source of them and also the source of our conscience. And all that sounds pretty good. And it sounds a lot like what Peter is saying at this point and challenges us about our motives, even our hearts. But what I want to ask is this man teaching what Peter would call godliness? being rightly related to God according to His Word and doing everything out of that motivation of worship. Well, let me read you what he says in another book. He calls the Trinity an apostate doctrine. He denies salvation by faith in the blood of Christ. He says that the church can redeem the dead. And he teaches that in addition to following the teachings of the Bible, it is essential to follow the teachings of the anointed prophets of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons. And I'm talking about Stephen Covey, author of The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Now, this is what I'm saying can happen even in our lives. Well, we are noticing areas of weakness in our character, and we are committed to working on them, but it's a matter of the motivation here. Are we really informed by Scripture? Do we really understand who the God is that we're trying to please and draw close to and become like? Morality is not godliness. This is not talking about self-help or personal improvement. This kind of character is possible only when we are rightly related to God through faith in Jesus Christ. I like the way that D. Edmund Hebert put it. He said, "Godliness brings the sanctifying presence of God into all the experiences of life. It keeps the believer from becoming hard and defiant toward opponents or succumbing to the temptation of a mere stoical endurance." And isn't that the way it often is in the Christian life? And even the way we deal with people, with ourselves or with our children. That life becomes a matter of just, you know, the stiff upper lip, just do the right thing because it's the right thing. Just buck up and straighten out. That is not the religion of the Bible. But the religion of the Bible says what's going in your heart, going on in your heart, reference to God right now. What is at the root? What is at the source of your actions? Get that straightened out first and primarily. This is what is meant by godliness. Now, how can we develop that? That's our third question. Well, it's just like we said last week about some of those other ones, that this is not going to happen overnight, that this is not going to happen just because we want it to. In fact, there's a verse that uses very graphic, athletic terminology. Reference to this attribute, it says, 1 Timothy 4:7, discipline yourself for the purpose of godliness. And that word discipline is a Greek word gymnazo. You might recognize that because we do get from it our English word gymnasium. And it's a word that smells like sweat. That is what is entailed here. It is a word speaking of intense effort, following hard after this. It does not become natural for us. This is something that takes the mindset and the commitment of an athlete to pursue this systematically, bringing God into every aspect of our lives and orienting all of our choices to Him. I mentioned a moment ago William Law. And one of the reasons that that book is so helpful, even though it's sometimes hard to get into it, is that he does suggest a system for doing this that to him was helpful. And the system is to stop at different specific times of the day to reorient yourself in prayer to God. And at each time, he has a specific issue to pray about. For example, he says early in the morning, you ought to pray largely in the way of thanksgiving and praise. And he suggests at 9 o'clock, why don't you stop everything you're doing and pray for the grace of humility? At noon, why don't you stop and pray for love for others? And as an expression of that love, that would be a great time to exercise yourself in interceding, in intercession, praying for other people and their needs. At 3 o'clock, maybe because that's the time of the day when most of us are drooping and when we tend to just kind of slide into the evening and lose awareness of God, he says, stop and deliberately resign yourself, surrender yourself once again to the will of God. And then what about the evening as you're wrapping up your day? That would be the time for self-examination and the time for confession of sin. Now, does that sound a little bit heavy, maybe even legalistic? I'm not saying we have to do this. I'm saying that whatever we do, we have to do something, or this is not going to happen. We have to develop some kind of deliberate method, or else time is going to go by and the hours are going to slip by and we will just be surviving through the day instead of approaching every aspect of our life as an act of worship. This is something that really has hit me this week, and even earlier, this word kind of put a specific term for what I was thinking about, but I do have to confess that this is something difficult for me. I remember when I was a student, I was a lot more sensitive about this. And I remember, you know, every time I go to class and have a quiz or take a test, pretty faithfully, I would bow my head and pray and commit that to God and ask Him to be honored and ask Him to help me. But now as a teacher, I've been teaching this stuff for years now, and I could teach it in my sleep in some cases. And how easy it is to just do what you're supposed to do and fulfill your obligations and get into this rut of just surviving and, you know, checking it off the list, and your heart before God is really not engaged. And the way to change that, which is something I have been working at this semester, is to stop and pray and reorient yourself to God, and then specifically to think on the attributes of God that call forth that fear and that love and that desire. What is it about God that elicits those kinds of worshipful responses? And do we really ever reflect on His holiness, on His omnipresence, on His sovereignty, on His love, on His justice? To what degree are those truths a regular part of our thought life? Well, that is godliness. What about the next one? What about brotherly kindness? What does that mean? We're going to define it again. First of all, as we get on past brotherly kindness, we have a related term, love, that is oriented a little bit differently than this one, and that typically in discussing the believer's character gets most attention. And how many times have you heard people, preachers, pointing out the necessary truth that love is a choice? That you shouldn't be waiting around, sitting around, waiting to be overwhelmed by all kinds of emotions. There are going to be times when you have to choose to do the loving thing. That is true, and we're going to go there. But the problem is, we can't emphasize that so much that love would get the impression emotion doesn't really matter. Love can be devoid of emotion and still be love. Well, you think about that reference to your own relationships, reference to God. Is this your picture of God? God looks at you and says, you know, you dirty rat, I don't like you. I wish I didn't have to do this. I would be more delighted to condemn you and punish you forever, but, you know, I'm God, so I'm supposed to love, so I'm going to send Christ to die for you, even though I don't really want to. Right. Is that our picture of God? What kind of a God would that be? We're just acting in that stoic way because I have to mentality. You listen to these words. Like as a father pities his children, so the Lord pities those who fear Him. He says about His sinful people, how can I give you up? My heart, Hosea 11, my heart is turned over within me. All my compassions are kindled. Those are emotive terms. And they're very helpful for this word because they use the family relationship as the image to convey the warmth and the tenderness of the heart of God toward us as His people. Whether it is father to child or husband to wife, love is more than a choice. And that's why this term is in this list, to adjust perhaps our perspective that there is an affectionate side to our relationships with people. The kind of affection that you would expect to exist between brothers in a family. It's most natural to that setting. And that's why other ways to translate it would include familial love. Somebody has said kinship affection. And even looking at the Greek word, this will be easy for us to understand. It is the word Philadelphia here. And that was deliberately chosen by William Penn to name his city. Why? Because he wanted it to be a place where people from all kinds of different backgrounds, from all races, from all religions, could live together in peace and harmony. He was a Quaker, and because of that, he knew what persecution, rejection, mockery was. He said there ought to be a place in the world where people from whatever background can get along and be happy and be in harmony together. So we're going to call this the city of Philadelphia, brotherly love. And even though we come from all kinds of different places, we're going to act like one big family. The irony is that last year, 2006, Philadelphia was rated as having the highest murder rate among the nation's 10 largest cities. 406 murders, which means more than one a day, or 27.8 per 100,000 inhabitants, which represented a 7.7 increase in murder over the year 2005. And it also ranked the highest, not just murder, but violent crimes generally, 1,562 of those per 100,000 people. Why can these people not get along? It'd be very easy to throw stones at them and to criticize them, but we have to admit that even in less violent places, we live in a society where families all over the place are broken up because of selfishness. And when people come into the church and they're challenged about this issue, they really don't have any background as to what brotherly love is because they've never really seen that shown within the family. It's a very, very sad day. And that's why we have to go back to the New Testament to see further descriptions of what this entails. Let me read to you some verses. Be kindly affection one to another with brotherly love, in honor preferring one another. So that part of brotherly love is an attitude of respect for people where you actually work at giving them preference, giving them the first place. Finally, be all of one mind, Peter says in 1 Peter 3:8, having compassion one of another. Love as brethren, there it is, be pitiful, be courteous. And connected with that word is sympathy and courtesy and kindness. Hebrews, let brotherly love continue, specifically entertain strangers, that is believers in this case, visiting from other parts. Take them in, meet their need. In fact, remember them that are in bonds as well as being bound with them. Hebrews 12, 1 through 3. This is what that feeling of affection produces, these practical efforts to show respect, to meet the need, to take people in, to show them courtesy. Now, why is that necessary? Well, you might expect I'm going to say something about the false teachers. And sure enough, as you look at chapter 2, these people, for example, in verse 13, it says that they count it a pleasure to revel in the daytime, stains and blemishes, reveling in their deceptions as they carouse with you, looking upon the church people as just another opportunity to have fun, to take advantage of them for my pleasure instead of trying to help them. So there is that warning. You don't want to become like this. Do you realize the kind of people who don't have that sort of affection? But we could even be simpler than that. We should love each other like brothers, because that's what we are. Brothers. That's the whole point. And just as two brothers, brother and sister in a family, have something that naturally ties them together, because they came from the same womb, they've drunk the same milk, they've eaten at the same table, they've gone through the same experiences, the common source is what binds them together and is what prompts them to be close. And I love the way Peter puts it in 1 Peter chapter 1, beginning of verse 22. We won't turn there, but this is the image that he gives us. We are to love each other fervently because we've all been purified and we've all been born from the same seed and we're all drinking the same milk into chapter 2. All of this shared background, even in spite of all of our other differences, is what pulls us together and creates this bond. So that leads us then to this third question. How can I develop this brotherly kindness? And by way of application, I would say that this comes first of all by working hard at sharing common experiences. Working hard to spend time together, doing things together that bring us together, things in the Lord's work. This is something I've really seen fleshed out in these mission teams that we've led. Every fall, we would get this group of students together, most of whom did not know each other. And at our first meeting, everybody was kind of nervous and kind of questioning, you know, who are these strangers that I'm going to spend 2 months with? Sort of checking each other out and coming to impressions. And we start in the cycle, and we begin to meet every week. We pray together. We pray together to see the Lord meet financial needs so people can go on the trip. And the Lord works great things to do that. We get on the trip and we are reaching out together and we are suffering sometimes together and praying and working and evangelizing and frustrated together and rejoicing together and good things that happen. And when those kids get back, we have young people that started out in that same sort of cold awkwardness, 2 and 3 years later, still getting together to eat once a week. Why? Because they went through these shared experiences that God used to bind them together. I think this is one reason why it is so important to be a vital part of a local church. Because that is how you get connected to the people of God. That is how you engage together in worship, in ministry, in activities that will be used of the Lord to take you through experiences together. That's how you get involved in each other's lives. But you know what? A football team has common experiences together. And they can become very close. Any civic organization can go through the same thing. Maybe people at your office, at your company, at your factory, whatever, are very close because they spend so much time together. And those common experiences, some enjoyable, some not. You just kind of bear it all together and that brings you close. Well, how is Christian brotherly kindness any different from that? I think this is where we begin to see the deeper level of affection here to say not just sharing experiences, but fellowshipping together in those things that supernaturally have drawn us into one body. So that, for example, when we come together, we are not just talking about the weather. We are not just talking about the ball game or about work, though all of that is fine. But we are going to the next level and really engaging our hearts. This is what God uses to bring people together, is sharing in common, fellowshipping over the things that matter most and that distinguish us from the world. I am sure that when the early church, Acts 2, continued in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship, they were talking about a lot more than the Super Bowl or whatever would be going on like that back in that day. It was making the Word of God, my spiritual growth, my spiritual needs, my answers to prayer, making that the focal point that brings me together. Now finally, and briefly, we do come to the word agape, which is love. And yes, there are some differences between these two, particularly as they occur together in a list of different items. This one is probably to be extended to all people in this context, since Philadelphia is something special to the community of Christians. It is something that has as its focus not the object, like I have this special affection for this person, but it is in the subject of the love, and in my choices to do practical things to display the effort to meet the need. I mean, Jesus told us that even toward our enemies we have to show this. And so there is more of a focus there on the will. Why is this necessary? Well, again, chapter 2, talking about the self-orientation of the false teachers, verse 3, what they rejoice in, what they get excited about is actually exploiting other people. Is that the path you want to go on, Peter says? But even broader than that, what did Jesus say? Bringing this up as so central, he says, by this shall all men know that you're my disciples. Here is maybe the chief characteristic of the disciple of Jesus. If ye have love, agape, one to another. How do I develop this? Well, there's no end of what could be said on that issue. And all I want us to do is to think through briefly what Paul teaches in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And I just want to read to you a list here, and we'll be done. These are paraphrases of the verses in 1 Corinthians 13 that deal with what love is as activities, and in fact as motivational statements. This comes from that book by Jerry Bridges. He says this is what it would mean to love, and this is what I need to be doing to develop that love. I am, first of all, patient with you because I love you and want to forgive you. I am kind to you because I love you and want to help you. I do not envy your possessions or your gifts because I love you and I want you to have the best. I do not boast about my attainments because I love you and I want to hear about yours. I am not proud because I love you and I want to esteem you before myself. I am not rude because I love you and I care about your feelings. I am not self-seeking because I love you and I want to meet your needs. I am not easily angered by you because I love you and want to overlook your offenses. I do not keep a record of your wrongs because I love you, and love covers a multitude of sins. And those are the kinds of daily choices that, if we will, with God's help, move upon ourselves through the Word of God, through prayer to take, we will see God developing agape in us. And of course, all of that on this foundation, and with this realization, tying this all together back to godliness, we love because He first loved us. We finished out the list. Those are the elements of spiritual stability. Those are the qualities that we ought to be striving to develop. In the case of today, godliness, brotherly affection, and love. And the question I've had to ask myself, I hope you'll ask yourself, what in those three, which one of those three do I find myself to be the weakest in? I need to be deliberate. I need to be systematic. I need to be focused about pursuing them.